Keep it forever?
I think you can keep it forever.
Oh.
Just next time, think of us.
Yeah. Good afternoon. My name's Elizabeth Baker Keffer, and I'm a vice president with The Atlantic, and welcome to this panel discussion, The American Dream Revisited. I'll turn things over to our moderator, who's Rich Wilhelm. He's a vice president at Booz Allen Hamilton, based in Washington, D.C. Prior to his work at Booz Allen Hamilton, he spent many years working in the White House on national security issues. And Rich is also a veteran of the Aspen Ideas Festival, I think 5 years running, so a good hand at leading a discussion like this. Right. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Elizabeth. The topic today is the American Dream, and it's a pretty broad topic. And to help us navigate this topic, we're going to, we have some very distinguished panelists. I'm going to briefly introduce them, and then we'll get into it. To my left is Nancy Gibbs. She's an editor at large at Time Magazine, is the author of more than 100, count them, 100 Time Magazine cover stories. Next to her, Linda Wertheimer is a senior national correspondent for National Public Radio, and you'd have to be living on the other side of the moon not to recognize the sound of her voice. Third, Tom Wilson, the chairman and president and CEO of the Allstate Corporation, Allstate Insurance Company. We're certainly in good hands today, Tom. And finishing up, Ann Mosley is Vice President for Programs at the Kellogg Foundation in Battle Creek, Michigan, providing overall direction for the foundation and managing its philanthropy and volunteer programming, human and financial resource allocation. So we're going to get a lot of different points of view today. One aspect of the American dream is the fact that Americans have been raised to believe in opportunity and that all things are possible. A key element in this concept is that of ownership, particularly of homes, which dates back to the Homestead Act of 1862 and has been a critical foundation of American economic growth for the past century. Over the past 20 years, we have witnessed growth in personal ownership by most Americans. Almost 70% own their homes. There has been a rise in the ownership of stocks and securities and a move away from defined pension programs to contributory 401ks and IRAs and that sort of thing. In many ways, wealth accumulation through appreciating assets started to replace the traditional social safety net of pensions and Social Security. However, the current financial crisis, triggered by the collapse of the housing bubble and magnified by the reduction in stock values, has raised concerns about an over-reliance on ownership as a means of accumulating a safety net. Given this backdrop, what does the American dream mean today? And is it synonymous with concepts of personal ownership? Is the basic social compact in American life very different from Europe in that we accept major income and wealth divides as not just the cost of a society that rewards individual striving, but also as a hallmark of its success? Is this still valid, if it ever was? The compact rests on the premise that any American can potentially rise to the top, or at least her kids can. To get the conversation going, I'm going to ask each of the panelists to say a little bit about themselves and respond to an opening question to get this conversation going. And that question is, and I'd like to start with you, Nancy, how has the definition of the American dream evolved? Have ownership and the American dream historically been synonymous, or do you see them as such today?
I think it is worth considering the fact that we date the phrase the American dream to a book published in the midst of the Depression in 1931. It was a book called The Epic of America by the historian James Truslow Adams, and this is how he defined it. It is not a dream of motor cars and high wages merely, but a dream of social order in which each man and each woman shall be able to attain the fullest stature of which they are innately capable. So from the very beginning, the American dream was not meant to be about stuff. It was meant to be about opportunity, about freedom, and what you could make of yourself if you had the moxie to get there. And this, of course, is very understandable in a country that I think prided itself of having watched empires rise and get fat and happy and then collapse under their own weight. Sacrifice was the muscle of a young country, and we were the ones who every time we hit a setback, we would, you know, pick ourselves up and suck it up and go reinvent ourselves. And so the idea that anyone can get anywhere if they work hard for it is so deeply embedded in the American DNA. The interesting thing to me is what has happened right now to that definition and whether it has changed because of this crisis. And I think we are seeing a fascinating paradox. On the one hand, we got to this point by having supersized the American dream. Over the last 30 years, our houses got 3 times bigger than the average house was 30 years ago. The average car is 89% more powerful. The average person has gained a pound a year, so that a person of a certain age 20 years ago weighed 20 pounds less than the person of that age now. And so I think one of the inevitable necessary things that has happened in this moment of national, the sort of national heart attack we had this fall, is that we all have had to stop and rethink whether our definition of the American dream was an appropriate one. And all of the polling that has been done has actually raised some sort of paradoxical issues. Time did a poll this spring in which we asked people whether they thought that it would be harder to achieve the American dream 10 years from now than it is today. And a large majority, more than 66%, said yes, it would be harder. A similarly big majority also said that they thought America's best days are ahead. So how can that be? Well, it's as though we know that times are hard, and therefore it's going to make us, that which does not kill me makes me stronger. We know that because we're going through this difficult period, because our dreams are going to be harder to achieve, it's going to make us better people, and so 10 years down the road, we're going to be in a better place than we are now. And so fully 72% of people, even now, even in these difficult times, say yes, they think it is possible to be start out poor, work hard, and end up rich, and that opportunity remains broadly open to people. And those numbers are even, it isn't only that they have not been knocked back by this moment. If you ask people whether you yourself have achieved the American dream already, 48% say yes, and that's 12 points higher than 4 years ago. There are so many paradoxes, I think, that this moment has put on the table in which people have had a chance to say, okay, how do I define happiness? What is it that I really care about? What is the dream for myself and my family that we are thinking about in a way that we were not even 6 or 8 months ago? And so that, I think, is why this is a particularly rich topic. We've been talking about the American dream for as long as, you know, America has existed. But this moment is a particularly interesting time to look at the fact that dream does not look and sound the way it did even a few months ago.
Well, I'm very impressed with Nancy's phrase, supersizing the American dream. I mean, it's clear that that's what we have done. We, you know, we live in families where every member of the family has a car. I mean, I'm not talking about families who live, you know, around this rim in Aspen, but families of a much more regular sort have a tremendous amount of stuff, have a lot of expectations, have, you know, all sorts of acquisitive notions about what the American dream might mean. And it seems to me that what we are doing in this moment is we're editing the American dream. And I think that one of the things that I am convinced is true is that if I had children, something which in the midst of my career in broadcasting I somehow omitted to do, but if I had children, I have to say that I would not wish them to be better off than I am. I think it would not be good for them to be better off than I am. I mean, I have a nice house, I have everything that I could conceivably want, and I have a very good job and very satisfying work and very good friends. And why would anybody want more than that? I can't imagine that it would be necessary to have more than that. And I wonder if we might not, as we, you know, think about the American dream, if we might think in a different way about what it is that is important, what we care about, and sort of edit our concept of the American dream. One of the things, I mean, I think home ownership is something that is, it is historic, it is basic. I mean, my grandfather was a Sooner, racing into the Cherokee Strip to claim a piece of Oklahoma in the last land rush. Going back to that is, we've all wanted land. I come from a part of the country where people don't just want land, and they only want all the land that touches their land. And I think that's really a hard one to shake. I mean, everybody does want to have their piece of this country. But I think even more than that, what people want is for their children to have opportunity. They want their children to have education. And I think that if we are in the process of editing the dream, then one of the things that goes by the boards is anything that stands in the way of education. I think that is still got to be the most important thing to most people in this country. And one of the interesting things that is happening with colleges like, you know, certainly the top-line colleges are making it possible for kids to go to school for nothing, not even with loans. Just go. And I think that the range of educational possibilities in this country is so great now that it's possible for kids to get an education. And I think that will be the last thing that we edit out of our dream.
Tom? I would go back a little farther than maybe Nancy did. I think it's really rooted in the Constitution, which is the pursuit of happiness, right? Life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. And that kind of changes over time. It changes by generation. You know, one time it used to be go get a piece of property out in Oklahoma or something. And sometimes it becomes a bigger car. So, but I think there's some commonalities amongst all of them. There's sort of freedom to choose. I think that's part of the American dream, whether that's your church you go to or where you live. I think there's, you know, that effort and talent matter. I think there's something about being part of America and being part of a country. I read this book like 30 years ago, so I don't remember this quote other than we picked it out, which is, it's in Democracy in America, which is de Tocqueville, and he called it anticipated success. And if you think about people like if you had relatives who immigrated here, they came here because they anticipated some success, and that was kind of the dream. And I think it's still alive and well. I mean, I agree with Nancy. You know, 72% of the people think it's going to be better. You know, there's optimism here. I think our morality is better. Our ethics are better. You know, we always beat ourselves up in America, but they're better than they were 100 years ago. I think we're currently challenged in thinking about it because we've the system has played out in our infrastructure, has cracks in it, and we don't have economic growth. So to the supersized piece, I think in the last 30 years, last 25, 30 years, our economic system, which is like this faceless machine to drive growth in America, has encouraged people to buy more stuff, take on more debt and all that kind of stuff. And we kind of ran out of gas. It's sort of like, you know how Coke bottles used to be, you have 6-ounce bottle of Coke, then they had 12, and then it was a liter, now, you know, and so you get these, and what Coke did was that they sold more, right? The big, so now you drink a 6-ounce Coke and you feel like you barely got started versus those big jugs, the big gulp. And our system did that with debt and consumer debt, and it just got us all ramped up, and we got ourselves out over our skis, and so now we have this correction period. And so we don't have growth, which has taken us out of all of our problems in the past. Even though our education wasn't any good historically, even though, you know, we had all kinds of problems, we grew because we had more people coming in, we had exports, we were, you know, rebuilding the world. And until we fix those cracks in the dike called the infrastructure and we figure out how to grow the economy, I think the American dream is going to be harder to get to. But I don't think we've lost our compass on it. I think Americans still have a sense of optimism.
Ann, you're in a major nonprofit. What's your view on this?
Well, I think it's sort of funny. It's coming. I'm going to sort of be, I guess, the voice a little bit from here and now. We've got the historical context. Having just flown in from Detroit and landing here in the beautiful land of Aspen, it's kind of, I feel like I'm very much straddling two worlds in a real-time way. And so, you know, working for a foundation, you know, our thing is we wake up and look at the lens of children and sort of the next generation. And the paradox, kind of for me, is, you know, this is really a time to reset and reimagine and reclaim the American dream. Because I think when the when you peel back the American dream, you know, this moment we are in, which is a huge kind of crisis of character, confidence, and also huge opportunity for our country. I mean, this is the one shared experience in my lifetime where we as a country have all experienced this and are feeling it at a visceral level. And that's sort of an amazing thing. But when I think about the 33 million plus kids that are living in poverty, their families and their parents, they haven't been full participants in the American dream yet. And so I think there's a piece when we talk about, when we have this opportunity to have this, you know, a new conversation, new investments, reimagine things like infrastructure. We've got this wonderful tradition of believing in the individual. But I think we have to remember the world that the individual lives in. You know, a lot of times we really applaud and succeed, whether it's that child from Harlem that comes out and beats all the odds, or, you know, from Carlsbad, New Mexico, that beats the odds. But what about if the odds were set up so that all kids could really succeed? So in a place like Michigan, where we see, national unemployment rates that are probably about 10%, give or take, look at some different data, they're, you know, three times that in my state. They are, when you look at communities of color, we're almost looking at a whole generation of wealth growth be wiped out. And so I think there's a real kind of, that we're going to have to pretty go deeply from a systems and a structural perspective to think about where we come out. And, you know, as a panelist, the optimism, I'm so intrigued by what I learned from Nancy and Tom this morning about people still having that optimism. So I thank you for that gift. Because I do know that even if you're in the poorest of poor communities, they still are, they are resilient. They are looking forward to the opportunity. I think the real challenges and opportunities for us now is how do we have an educational system? We transform that culture of education so that the next generation, and frankly, the generation of parents that are losing their jobs and struggling forward, they have a meaningful pipeline that's going to put them on a path for a career. And that's, you know, that's a million-dollar question for all of us here in the country. I mean, somebody joked on an earlier panel, if you want to get into the White House, just talk about the word jobs. Jobs, jobs, jobs. And so, I think for us to be really sober about where we are and both the things that we have to celebrate as a country and also be really clear about the work we have left to be done.
I'm intrigued. A couple of you mentioned, this idea of it's going to be harder. Maybe we have too much stuff. Nancy, you wrote an article in Time magazine last October saying real patriots don't spend. And do you think it's possible to reprogram the Americans and particularly politicians to value thrift as a virtue or to adopt it? And, you know, if so, what impact is that going to have on our economy and on the American way of life?
Well, the first thing that would be necessary would be to see it as a virtue. And, you know, for the first couple million years of human history, saving and investing made no sense. You hunted and killed and you moved on, and it wasn't until people started settling down in one place that they needed to store seeds and surpluses and plan for the future. And so we've now had 10,000 years to absorb the lesson that thrift and savings matters, and we still haven't quite mastered it yet, I would say. And it's partly because at a lot of different times in our history, again, thrift has not been held up as a virtue to aspire to. Certainly during the Depression, you had economists start to say that thrift was the contemptible vice which threw sand into the gears of the consumer economy. And we've heard this again now in this cycle about the paradox of thrift, of the problem that at this particular moment we don't want people to be thrifty because we need them to be out buying things, so we need to make things so that our economy gets back up on its feet. So, you know, we've been living in an atmosphere where not only was thrift not valued, we were buying our baby daughters the little pink onesie that says "Born to Shop" with purses on it. And the notion was that saving was for suckers. You know, the old saying, there are no pockets in a shroud. The last thing you wanted to do was die and leave money on the table. And so we've been immersed in that culture that not only, not that thrift isn't good, it's that thrift was bad, it was foolish for the better part of a generation. And I think it's going to take some doing, and certainly take the kind of shock to the system that we've had, to rewire us. On the other hand, we also saw that we went from a period where people saved typically, you know, 15%, and then it dropped to about 4%, and then it dropped to negative numbers a couple years ago, and now it's back up to 6% again. We've had a very sudden pulling back and retrenching that we all have read about and followed. I don't count that. I don't think that retrenchment is the same as repentance. And so what we are seeing right now, which has been a great festival of thrift in the country, does not necessarily mean that we have retrieved it and will elevate it as a virtue.
You know, I don't agree with that. I think in some ways, I mean, some of it I agree with, but I think for 25 years, last 25 years, savings rate has been low. Before that, for 40 or 50 years, it was in the 8 to 10% range, all up through the early 80s. And I think it was just when we supersized, because we ran out of growth, we said, quit saving stuff. So I think we can get America back to saving. I think if you look at people who are over 50, they got no choice now, right? They got to start saving because they've lost the money in their house. If you look at people who are younger, they see this, and I think they'll change. And I think one of the problems I see is our government is trying to encourage people to spend, to incur more debt. And for our economic problem, that's like bloodletting. You know, we got rid of bloodletting centuries ago, and this is the problem we have. And I think, and not only do I think people will start to save more because they'll have no choice, I actually think the government should encourage them in this transition from a consumer consumption economy, which fueled our growth here and growth in China and everywhere else in the world. We just got to get over that and take our lumps. I'm more optimistic that people will do what's in their best interest, which is, I think savings rates getting up to 6% are low. I think they will go up from there.
Even among young people, Generation Wires, and this is, there's no science behind this, I don't know what the polls say, but an amazing number of young people that I talk to, if they could, would trade off a health plan, and they would also not contribute to a contributory retirement program, even if they had the opportunity. Now, I don't know if there's any, maybe that's changing as a result of all of this, but that's sort of my experience. What, do you have a take on that?
Well, when you look at people close to retirement, they are going to start to save because they have no choice. There is a group of people who are probably in the some of the baby boomers who we define ourselves by what we own. So I happened to be at the health club one day, and I'm getting changed, and there's two guys next to me at the locker, and they start talking to each other, and they obviously know each other, but they don't know their names. But they realize they're both Porsche people. So they connect by, so they've defined themselves as Porsche people. I think there is a portion of our country, to Nancy's point, that has defined ourselves by what we own. But I think older people who are getting closer to retirement will have to save, and I think younger people, my oldest is only 20, but I don't think she has the same aspirations to accumulate and spend the way, my 16-year-old son won't let us get a new car even though it's all dinged up and no one wants to drive it because he thinks it's, you know, a bad symbol. So I don't know. I mean, it's speculative. I'm guessing. But I think that in general, we act in our own best interest as a country. And I think that's what we did for the last 25 years. We spent too much. We didn't have any growth. So I think what we have to do is fix our education system, fix our healthcare system, fix our roads, our public transportation, and we got to figure out how to grow. And I think you see a lot of stuff today being done on that part, people talking about education, people talking about healthcare, but nobody, I was surprised when you said, you know, get a job in the administration by talking about jobs, because I don't see any plan at all. I don't see any job. I see everybody just saying throw a bunch of whole money into the economy and hope people spend it, which I think is a bad idea.
It's pretty apparent from all the surveys that have been done that Americans tend to be very optimistic. But Linda, is this optimism well-founded in your view?
I think that this country still has so many assets that it's impossible not to be optimistic at some level, that at some point in time we will, you know, we will recover from what's from where we are now. It seems to me that we, you know, we have land, we have assets, we have well-educated citizens, we have we are hard-working people for the most part, not afraid to, you know, not afraid to get in there and do what we need to do. And I think that those kinds of things are, you know, those are verities about this country. And that, it seems to me, that that justifies a certain level of optimism about what happens next. We need, and, you know, and many people think we have, leadership that will help move us into and through this period. And we need... I am very, as I said, education seems to me to be the most important thing that we need to do. But the other thing is we need to figure out what it is that America makes that the world takes, to paraphrase Trenton. And I think that it's a serious question. Inventing, we went through a period of inventing extraordinary things with the internet, which resulted in the internet bubble. But coming out of that, we still have technology advances that are tremendous, health advances that are tremendous, a tremendous amount of work done in science that ought to, you know, that will eventually begin to run in the right direction. So I think it's hard not to be optimistic in this country unless, as you say, you're living in, you know, someplace where people are just being ground down, like Detroit.
I think for those of you who are looking for the case for optimism, Kurt Anderson, who's doing a session tomorrow morning, has his book is coming out in a couple weeks called Reset, to go to Anne's point. And he makes the case for why this particular moment in our history, given how we got here and what we've experienced and what we've learned, sets us up for, you know, a tremendously hopeful kind of national renewal. And I don't think of Kurt as being a kind of pie in the sky character, but he makes a compelling argument. I hope that he's right. But I also think, you know, both of you made the point about schools and education. You know, if schools are institutions, among other things, where we're trying to teach children responsibility and we fund them by lotteries, then we are fundamentally mixing our messages. And I think if the public message that we're sending in the way our public officials or our corporations and our private institutions conduct themselves is either spendthrift or irresponsible or reckless, then, you know, that there's a contagion to that. And, you know, the flip side, the optimistic case, is that we now are set up for a sort of virtuous circle, and that the collective trauma that we have suffered will produce, you know, as with the heart attack, the person who says, oh, maybe now I should, I know I was supposed to eat right and exercise more, and it always would have been good to spend more time with my family. Now I'm actually going to do that, that it took this kind of a shock to our political system, our economic system, and to our personal moral bearings to have people really stop in their tracks and rethink the direction that we were going in.
I think there's some reason to believe that this last election was perhaps pointing in that direction, because I kept meeting people around the country who would tell me how stunned they were to think that they might actually be voting for Barack Obama. I mean, I met this guy in Wisconsin in the Main Street Cafe in Bloomer, Wisconsin, which I recommend to you because the Dutch caramel apple pie in that place is to die. The guy said, he said, I'm thinking, I'm trying, I'm going back and forth. Today, I'm thinking I'm voting for the black boy. And I'm thinking, can I put that on the radio? I don't know. And I called my boss and I said, here's what he said. And I played him the tape. And he said, well, I think we have to put it on the radio because he's making a decision he could not possibly have contemplated even 5 years ago, and he's going to do it. So we want to, you know, we want to put that on the radio. So, of course, it being NPR, he had to have sensitivity meetings and discuss whether he could do it. And they decided to do it. But I met people over and over again who were making decisions, political decisions. For the first time, they were thinking, they're not all alike. The choice is a different, you know, which we choose one thing or the other thing. And they were making a decision with which they were not comfortable, but they were making it. And I, you know, that's an indication which, you know, like many other things, if you talk to enough people down at ground level, you can see what's coming, as you know from all your polling. You can see what's coming better than a lot of people do. And even in a year ahead of the election, people were very, very worried about the state of the economy and the state of their personal economies before it really, you know, crashed down on us in the fall. And I heard that, and I'd take that as a kind of a vote for change, for future, for going on, for moving on.
Yeah, if I can actually add on to that point a little bit. I think because, you know, it's different. I'm on my Facebook, it actually says, you know, how you self-describe, I'm a radical optimist. I'm certainly not a radical optimist, not an anti-optimist. I'm like, wow, I've never been accused of that. But I'm teasing. But I think there's a piece about, as Linda's sort of articulating, people are really, I don't think people, they don't have the set vision of where we're going. And so it's a little bit of taking that collective leap of faith and being open to a new path, which is such an incredible opportunity for us, and I think as a country, on so many levels. And the shift, especially from a consumer-driven society to reclaiming a citizen frame, is an incredibly important opportunity. And what these elections gave us the opportunity to kind of a whole new segment of our communities jumped into a conversation. The actual numbers, it felt like for many at least, I thought, oh my gosh, it was such a surge, and no matter which way you went, it just felt like there were so many more people voting and participating. The numbers were not actually that significantly larger. It was in fact a whole different body of people were participating. And so I think this piece about how we're reclaiming citizen and community in this conversation is really important. And that also right now, I mean, our future, especially in the American Dream economic perspective, we're looking for a new formula. The growth margins we had were never sustainable. I'm not an economist, but they never felt sustainable before everything crashed. I was living in Washington at the time. How is this sold in a day? You could drive through neighborhoods of Baltimore and you could see other streets where foreclosures, eviction notices were going up. It took so long for that, if you were on the street, what you could see and feel, for that to become this national calamity. And so I think, I guess a piece of what I'm sort of saying is, it's actually recircling to a belief in really the American people. There's a lot of in our leadership about how we're having dialogues and we're moving towards actions. Because I think everybody's struggling about what's the answer around jobs at the administration and this flow of investment. But how we're able to be concrete and innovative in terms of bringing people in and communities in to being part of this conversation about what the infrastructure, the pathways, the choices will look like.
You know, the programs that you run are targeted at a particular segment of the American society. What does the American dream look like to them, to those people living paycheck to paycheck? Is it do they believe it's attainable?
Yeah, well, it's actually they do. I think again the polling, and I'm not sort of a polling expert, that the majority of folks, you know, don't believe they're going to be better off than their parents. When you're dealing in different pockets, whether it's rural poverty or urban poverty, you know, there still is a sense of hope. There still is a sense of resilience. But sort of two of the most important economic indicators for a low-income child is their family income and their parents' educational attainment and kind of that family aspirational standpoint. And so I worry for the programs that we fund, we don't really operate, but we fund programs, it could be just a real dampening of a sense of opportunity and worry about losing a generation. We're seeing lots of numbers. You know, the numbers of non-college-bound youth are soaring. At the same time, when we look at the jobs of the future, at least 4 out of 10 are going to require post-secondary education. So I feel like there's, you know, especially when you're dealing with the populations of low-income communities where I work and try to fund with my colleagues, is how are we narrowing gaps? How are we creating opportunities? Because it's not the same game. They don't have the same access to institutions, the same level of voice. You know, when you look at the foreclosure issue, which, you know, can be any community in Detroit, it's completely out of control. But, you know, they don't have access to, there isn't fairness in terms of access to the high-quality financial education, access to even the opportunities to get your call returned, to get your, you know, your loan reworked. And so a lot of what we try to focus on is helping by funding local people and organizations, helping them increase their voice, help build access to pipelines and opportunities. And without question, our entire education system needs to be redone. And it's interesting, places like, I'm really excited to see Michelle Rhee. I used to have my kids in D.C. public schools. Now they're in Ann Arbor public schools, but really curious to hear about what's going on in D.C. Places like New Orleans, they're rebuilding the entire school system through charter schools. More than half of the schools or the kids in New Orleans are in charter schools. You know, does that what it take? Are we going to have to innovate out of the system? So those are some of the things we're thinking about.
I think we are going to have to do something. I think, you know, because we've run out of growth, and I think Nancy said this too, that education is very important to get us out of here. It's sort of like you start a new business and everybody wants your product, and so you're making it like crazy. People work in a factory, they make mistakes, your distribution doesn't work really well, but you're still doing well because everybody wants your product. And that's what happened in America. We didn't have great infrastructure, but we kept growing. We quit growing, and now all the cracks show up. And education is, I think, it comes up in almost every conversation you have with anybody about fixing the American dream. I know in my family, it was always viewed as education's really important, and just get education. And so it gives people access. But it feels to me like we need to do something on the people. We can't leave all these people behind who even are middle-aged or have gotten out of jobs. We have to figure out how to re-educate people. And today, and not just only, I think K-12 is really important. I think, you know, early childhood education is really important. You're probably all familiar with the concept of compound interest, at least in this group, you know, where interest on interest, you know, that's, most people in America wouldn't know that, by the way. 37% of the people can't calculate a 10% discount. But compound interest is very prevalent in my business, right? That's economics. I think there's something like in terms of compound intelligence that the more you know, the more you can learn, the faster you can learn, and you have to grow. So we have to fix, you know, preschool work. We have to fix K-12. But I think we can't also just assume those people who are 30, 40, even 20 who dropped out of high school, we can't just leave them sitting there. We got to help them figure out how to get the American dream. And I think it's going to require us figuring out how to get them back to school or get them retrained or do something so that we can get the kind of growth. Because without the brains working this stuff, who knows how many, you know, wonder drugs we haven't created or how many great pieces of art because somebody's not around. So I think this education, for me, everywhere we go, it shows up as a key part of the American dream is fixing it.
Yeah, and actually one piece on that, I think, on the education that doesn't actually get funded as much as it needs to, and it's the winning strategy, is how to couple education with wraparound supports. We've been actually jumping back into the community college system with total trepidation and fear. I mean, it's like literally about 85% of people entering community colleges are not prepared to, you know, be out of high school. I mean, it's a huge issue, and the community colleges are going to swell like we haven't seen as the economy continues to move on. And we've been learning about some really interesting work coming out of working with folks like the United Negro College Fund and other kind of centers for working families in the community colleges, that for many students, they drop out of whether it's community college or a four-year institution because of something happens in their life that throws them off the path. If you're living by, it's sort of a house of cards. So if you're a kid coming up in a low-income community, it might be a violent situation in your neighborhood. It might be something that a payment hasn't come through and you're living paycheck to paycheck. The smallest thing can take you off course. And so I think a lot about the holistic supports that we can bring, whether it's through many community colleges are looking at achievement coaches to really be there and coach. And maybe sometimes it's just a little bit of coaching, and $100 to get someone through the bus fare to keep going to schools can keep someone from falling off the path. And so I think there's also in this space to be kind of common sense about how we're really helping people cross the finish line.
I'd like to ask one final question before we open it up to the audience for questions. And I'd like to direct this initially to Tom. You're the CEO of one of the largest corporations in the United States. What advice would you give to a young person, and I'll define a young person less than 30, okay, in your company, on what the path to the American dream would look like, and in particular, contrast that with the way you looked at it when you entered the workforce?
Well, you asked me to do some self-reflection. That could be difficult. I could do the first part easy. It's always easy to give advice. It's a little harder to sort of write.
That they like good stories.
I think I would tell young people today, really first figure out what your purpose is. You know, what is it? What's your passion in life? What do you really want to achieve? I'd be clear about, at least know what you want to achieve today. I would tell them to make sure they pursue that with great vigor and became very good at it, whatever it was. If it was, be in business, I'd get smart about it. I'd go to school. If it was painting, I'd figure out how to do well at that. So, because I think it's more than just, I think the American dream is more than just money. And I think most people think about it that way. My parents didn't have a lot of money, but they wanted their kids to do better. I'm glad they felt that way because they pushed us and helped us and made sure we got educated. So I think it's very individual, I guess what I said. But I'd be clear about it as a 20-year-old, and it will change over time. How has it changed for me? I don't know that y'all care that much particularly about my own life, but it probably started out with just monetary and success or doing well in business. I think since then it's morphed beyond where I've achieved more success than I thought I would ever have. So now, my purpose, I do have it written down, which is to help people achieve more meaning and success in their lives. So when I'm running our foundation, when I'm looking at our foundation or I'm looking at our employees, I'm about trying to help them figure out what they want to get out of life because I think that's what I'm trying to get done. And along the way, I got to run a business, but that's not as hard as the other part.
Linda, can I ask you the same question?
I think that I'm in a line of work which is kind of falling apart at the moment. everybody's figuring that there is some, web-like future out there, and when nobody knows quite what it's going to look like, and will we have newspapers and blah, blah, blah. And I so it's hard to say that somebody should necessarily that I would advise someone to go into the area where I am, except that. You'd have more fun than 90% of the jobs that you might get because you get to, you get to ask people questions all the time. And, questions are never embarrassing, but answers sometimes are. it's a great line of work, but it's a difficult thing to go into. I think that this country runs on information. So I'm sure that there will have to be something that will replace, when you go out from your house, I live in Washington, I pick up the Washington Post and the New York Times, and I feel like they are maybe 20 pages each. And I'm remembering, when papers weighed pounds. And it's very distressing. But I think that is an area where invention will take place, where creativity is possible, where somebody is going to figure out how to make this happen, I hope, in a timely fashion so that we don't have to live without information for a period. But I think that if I were, if I were able to sort of magically do anything, I would suggest to people that they invest in children. I mean, I think that the part of the American dream that really matters is that your children should do better. And so, you need to look for children who need to do better. That would not be my children if I had any, because they don't, I think they would be doing fine. But children who do need to be lifted up, that is where, there can't be a better place to put your money than in children.
Let's open it up to the audience. Any questions for our panelists? Yes?
I'm not sure I have a question, but I think the American dream is were very materialistic in their interpretation of the American dream. I think probably somebody up there said success was part of our American dream, but our children, I find, you know, you tell them they can do anything in the world, and then they come back with what they want to do, and you go, oh, not that, you know. but they have found ways of being fulfilled that are things that we never imagined. So we have one daughter who stands in her, up to her knees in the Pantanal and studies wood storks, and another who wants to work in the inner cities. And I just feel that this is a very important part of our American folklore that we need to keep alive and well.
Hi, I don't know if this was intentional, but you guys are all sitting in front of a banner that says, every great dream begins with a dreamer. And so I thought that was very apropos. Apropos of that, I want to ask Ann in particular, but any of you who have a comment on this. you know, my son is a teacher in New Orleans for Teach for America. And one thing that struck me in visiting his classroom was that I did a little session on Barack Obama just before he was being inaugurated. I was actually there the weekend before inauguration. I was there the Friday before inauguration. And I talked to them about Barack Obama and what it meant to them. And the sense of it, after once they got loosened up and were talking to each other, was some of them connected with the fact that a dream, having a dream and realizing a dream is possible. But I was really struck by the fact that a lot of them didn't connect to it. And I wondered what your experience is in working with, you know, programs that work in these communities, and whether or not do we have to teach these children what the dream means again? Do we have to restate the dream? It really disappointed and saddened me, because I thought of any time of any day that there was going to be something that the kids were going to be able to relate to, it would be that. And you know, maybe it's going to take a while for them to believe that it's real, that the consequences of that will trickle down to them. I don't know. I don't know where the disconnect is, and of course, didn't have time to, you know, explore that with them. But that was one thing that struck me. And when I was looking at that, every great dream begins with a dream, and thinking, you know, yes, the American dream exists, and you know, everyone in this room is lucky enough to understand whatever it means to us and our children. But there's a whole cadre of children. Let's focus on the kids. Who, I mean, do they see themselves as part of the American dream, I guess?
Well, I really appreciate that comment, and I would probably approach it from a flip perspective, in that I think the most important step for us to authentically do is to fundamentally value all children and let them feel that love, that true belief in their potential. And I don't think that, I think children are so much smarter and realer than we ever give them credit for. If you ever want, like, my daughter's, you know, she's 9. And if I ever want to get the right answer, like, does this look right? No. I mean, kids will tell you stuff. Time with foster kids, you know, just they're really common sense. You know, I think we have a serious recommitment to make to the next generation of kids. And, you know, I have had the opportunity to go through both some of the public schools and the charter schools in New Orleans. And the thing that is so exciting about some of the charter school work is they are fundamentally about resetting expectations. And every teacher in that school believes every child is college material. You know, again, I'm coming into this work from more of a civic engagement perspective and a little bit more around family economics here, so I'm not an education specialist. But you walk into a room and you know whether the children are valued. And that means being everything from, how was your day? How is, you know, your mother? How is, you know, what did you learn? Calling on them, not ignoring them. I mean, the lives that our children feel, we are, you know, many of us, this is not in our daily routine. There is a real disconnect about how children are greeted. And actually, we're doing some really interesting work in Mississippi with the superintendent down there, Hank Barnes. Phenomenal guy, has done a complete review from a child's life of wake up, have your Kellogg cereal, go forth to school, where is your bus stop, is that, you know, do you have a cover, Do you not? Does the bus driver, does he or she treat you like, nice to see you? Or do they not even look in your eyes? How you actually march through your day. And so I just think we have to get real about how we have just kind of written off in many ways, can these children really succeed? And it's when you go to people, whether superintendents or teachers, there's a real check to be made, because I think there's a lot of folks that are in those jobs that are doing those jobs not for a purpose and a passion, but really more from a job standpoint. And I think the reimagine opportunity we have to really believe in those kids. And I think if they felt that, they would see themselves as a potential president as well.
I don't know if you have seen him while you've been here, but Bishop T.D. Jakes has been here. And he's just sort of a mountain of a man who is, according to my nice Jewish husband from Brooklyn, a spellbinding preacher. When Fred said that to me, I was stunned that he had ever listened to anybody preach, because I'd never heard of it. But he said, in one of the sessions where I was, he said that he was quoting, I guess it must be Christ to St. Peter, "Go thou and be fishers of men." He said that so many people have never been fishing. Take a kid fishing. Take a young man fishing, that even reaching out to people on that kind of, you know, level makes a big difference.
You know, poverty, I think, I assume this is an impoverished community, right? Teach for America. If you ask poor people or nearly poor people, how would you describe poverty? They say hopelessness. So I think being poor, being left out of the economic system, can kill the American dream. Nancy had some interesting numbers this morning about happiness that might get to this sort of, you know, unless we get people above some certain level, they won't be able to achieve the American dream.
There's a whole school of scholars of happiness, but one of the things that has struck me most is that up until you reach the median household income in this country, which is roughly $55,000, there is a direct correlation between money and happiness. And having a little more money will actually make you a little happier, or it'll relieve your stress about if you get sick or lose your job or whatever. So there's parallel lines up until you reach that midpoint. At that point, the lines diverge, and there is no longer any correlation between money and happiness, so that you can earn $500,000 a year or $5 million a year and not be likely to be any happier than the person who is at the median. Now, I'm tempted to say we all know this, that it's the oldest cliche that money does not buy happiness, and that we all know miserable rich people, and that we've seen in our own lives how even people who find themselves earning vastly more and having vastly greater resources than they ever thought they would do not, you know, you find that your expectations grow as well, or that you're it's something psychologists call the hedonic treadmill, where you are constantly wanting the best, wanting more stuff. And what happens is that once you are a maximizer, once you are on that treadmill, it makes it very hard to be satisfied. You're always second-guessing yourself. There's much less likelihood for peace of mind, whereas if you are, rather than being a maximizer, if you are a satisficer, if you are someone who is satisfied with what you have, it frees you up to appreciate all sorts of other things, appreciate your relationships, pay attention to other things, rather than, you know, how important is it to me that I buy that $700 pair of sandals that actually pinch, but they are what's in this season. So the lack of correlation between money and happiness is, on the one hand, so obvious, but on the other hand, one of the things that we've seen, again, of the paradoxes of the polling this winter is that when times are hard, people are likely to hang on to their dreams all the more urgently. And therefore, there's a huge incentive to redefine your dreams. And so the redefinition of success and of happiness and of the American dream that has been occurring through this period has much less to do with material possessions and much more to do with experiences. And so if you look at, there was one survey that I pulled out called the American Reality Study. And in the American Reality Study, which was published this winter, when people were asked to select the top 10 attributes that they connect to success, Number one, at 88%, was spending quality time with family. Having a good relationship with your spouse or partner at 86. Being healthy at 81. Having a good work-life balance at 80%. Being a good parent. The material measures were at the bottom. Owning the home of your dreams, 31%. Earning a high income, 22%. Having nice belongings, 13%. So what we've seen is, I think, this radical redefinition of success and happiness and the attributes that go with that towards things that have much more to do with relationships and experience and connectedness and community. I don't think it's an accident that we've seen an explosion of volunteerism, of applications to divinity school, of applications to Teach for America. I mean, they're through the roof this way. And I don't think it's just because, you know, there are no other jobs. I think this is an affirmative thing of I am seeking to travel down a road that is about satisfaction. It's about connecting to other people. It's about, you know.
This may be a question for Rand, but
here, go ahead. Okay. He was actually waiting for a
while. I have a quick one, which you answered a little bit, but as an architect, we were told through school and through my whole career that home is an American dream. Now, I see home as some place where you raise children, that you have a dining room table, that culturally pass conversation and knowledge, that it's more than a shelter. I'd like you to answer or speak to a second on whether home's important in that whole equation of raising family and a part of the American dream.
Having a home obviously is important, and way too many poor people don't have decent homes the way you described it. Owning a home, there's actually been some new research done economically that says it's a bad thing to have home ownership as high as we have it in America because people don't move around as much. So they get stuck to their house, they lose their job, they can't move, they can't sell their house, as opposed to if they were renting, they could go someplace else.
And I guess the question for you, what continues to amaze me with all the inner city unemployment that there isn't more social unrest. And I don't know if that's a tribute to government, a tribute to the morals and ethics of the American people, even these people that have been out of work for years and years, but with you know your experience in the Detroit inner city, how are we avoiding all this?
Wow. It's interesting. God, I don't know if I have an answer for that because I think it's a great question. And I did some work in Indian country way back, and I learned a lesson that was really important to me. Where I was working with a tribal leader, and he said, "You know, you never want an uneven handshake. You must have a fair deal." And I was like, "And this was, you know, working directly with tribes. How many fair deals have they had?" And he really, we had this long philosophical conversation about the importance of unevenness. And we were actually going with him on a trip to go do some deal negotiations with the corporation. And I was all about getting the tribe as much money as I could. I was like, I was ready. And he's like, no. And he's like, it's about being even, about being fair. And I think when you're out of balance, like our country actually is right now, the spread between the haves and the have-nots, the opportunity gap is growing. I think it's a really fair question to be asking. And last week, we were on a board retreat up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is probably one of the stronger spots in Michigan, where I hadn't realized back in the 60s they had riots in terms of issues around poverty and equity. And then you just look in a place like Michigan, Benton Harbor, which is another community that had really extreme civil unrest or riots, or Detroit. This is a great question. It's something I think about just because from a balance perspective, but I think it's something people could pay a little bit more attention to. I don't think there's some, I think if we continue to leave a generation behind, we will suffer consequences in some way.
Thank you. There was a young African-American artist who coined a phrase that always stuck with me. He says, I want to be an ascendant descendant. And I guess it's a land of opportunity to be able to take it one step further from where you're coming from and where you're going is a dream that everyone has. And I think America is a platform for doing that. My concern as a collective society, are we letting down our kids with all the borrowing we're doing from the future, Are we not giving them the same chances we've had to do and all the things we want to do? The job market isn't there for the kids. The Teach for Americas are there for volunteerism, but for regular jobs out there to really participate, are we not giving them the right platform that our last generation gave us?
Anybody want to take that?
Sounds like everyone agrees with your concern. If you're looking for a solution, I would put it into two buckets: fix the infrastructure and get some real economic growth. I think fixing our education system, healthcare, public transportation will give more people access to the American dream. Those are long burns. In my company, as long as it takes to break something, it takes about that long to fix it. So if we've been broken for 15, 20 years, it's going to take 15, 20 years to fix it. So I think we need to do that. But I think we also have to worry about sort of growth tomorrow. And I think this is where we need more work on giving people more jobs. You know, having a job in America is part of the dream. You know, you feel like you're contributing. You feel like you're a productive person. I have a brother who's been unemployed for a year and a half. If he's unemployed for another 3.5 years, he's going to feel like the American dream is a long way away. So I think finding a way to get people more jobs is really important to us today.
In the back.
Oh, well, I'm very intrigued by this question about civil unrest, and I wondered two things. One, if anybody on the panel knows anything about what's been happening in the last decade in terms of policing and incarceration and how that may or may not be connected to civil unrest. And then, of course, we know that Martin Luther King left us with the idea that riot is the voice of the unheard. But I think for people to even know they're unheard, they have to have some aspiration which is larger than individual sort of materialistic goals. And I don't know, but are even the people who might be causing civil unrest or might be causing social movements, are they caught in the same kinds of things that you've been critiquing about people who had larger amounts of money? I mean, in Los Angeles, during that riot, I think people really thought, the kids I talked to really thought it was a revolution. Now, they didn't get very far. And they really thought they were speaking about justice and injustice. They had many occasions to be calling no justice, no peace in the streets. And so without meaning, I don't know that there would be what's called civil unrest. And then secondly, as I've said already, I mean, what's going on in terms of policing and incarceration?
There's nothing in my experience that would
allow me to... We know that one in 99 Americans is in jail. Something like 1% of our population is in prison. Many of them are in prison for nonviolent crime related to drugs and related to, sentencing structures that have been put in place after years of political campaigning on getting tough on crime. Things like that that have to be changed. And there is some movement to change them, but it's a state-by-state thing. It has to, you know, there are 24 states, I believe, with three strikes laws now. There are the possibility that, you know, the kid with a $1,200 set of golf clubs is locked up for 30 years, you know, because it was a third strike. I mean, those kinds of things are happening all over the country, and that is got to be, I mean, it's a disaster. One of the interesting things, according to Justice O'Connor, is that the failing economy is making it impossible for states to carry the burden of incarcerating so many people. California is beginning to release prisoners, you know, going through their prison population and looking for people who are sentenced for nonviolent crimes and letting them out early because they can't afford it. It's obviously that is a huge problem. And then the whole question of reentry from prison, again, with access to any kind of possibility that you can grasp a part of what we think of as the American dream, is another whole area where we need, where a tremendous amount of work needs to be done. I mean, there are programs like the Fortune Society in New York and many other programs, but it's, you know, it's like spitting into the whirlwind at this point. So clearly that's an area that's a whole population that never has had the kind of access that we're talking about to possibility. The only possibility they have seen has been, you know, in a direction which has landed them in jail.
Yeah, I think building on Linda's comments, and I think it's actually a really provocative conversation, really probing, because you look at different events happening outside of the country and look at unrest and people protesting or speaking out, and it is kind of amazing it hasn't happened yet. And, you know, when you drill down on those numbers, especially on incarceration, there's a very clear story directed at men of color and also growing numbers of women as well. But, you know, that's something we really, there's some, you know, really important racial lenses to take on how our systems are working for us to really be kind of fundamentally assessing that. And it's interesting because the situation in Michigan, we spend more on our prisons than on our education. And right now with the budget crisis, anything, you know, in states can happen. So it's a really, really intriguing time. But I just think the issues of incarceration, and there are some pockets of innovation with some community colleges that are developing some different kinds of pipelines that are really important. And again, a lot of times in budget questions, people say, we don't have money for that. And again, we don't have money not to do that, because this is a real, this is a whole population that's been tracked out of the system, you know, for different structural issues around that. But I think it's really, really quite important.
You know, here's another statistic that is really lovely. One in 49 children in America has a parent in jail. I don't know if that's true. I read that in one of the study papers that I was reading for a panel I was on. But if that's true, that's just horrifying.
And I'll sort of, another piece on sort of picking it up, I'm really upbeat today. On the American Dream, part of the American Dream is also based on, you know, kind of a mother and a father living in the house, everybody kind of getting along and going through the day. And when we look at the numbers of children that are growing up in a single parent family, and specifically a woman-headed family, those numbers are skyrocketing. And just looking at some data that came out from the Economic Policy Institute just recently, the half of the kids living in a woman-headed family are living in poverty. And, you know, kind of, especially in middle and lower income, the economic formula to sort of security and stability is based on two parents and two parents actually working. The whole kind of phenomenon of single parents and sort of how our families are structured, you know, take away any judgment or anything, you know, it's a very different phenomenon what that will look like for kids.
And get ready to, I'd like to take us out on sort of an uplifting note. And Tom, this morning, talked, I think, pretty eloquently about a book he'd read about the third half of life to show how the American dream evolves throughout one's life. I mean, could you talk a little bit about that, and then we'll finish up?
Great thing about America is we can have these kind of conversations. We can beat ourselves up and figure out what our problems are. But I am a believer in America. I think betting against America is a bad idea because we have so many resources. We just have to have the will to change it. And as we define the American dream, there's a guy, Ken Dykewald, who wrote a book, he talks about, and the conversation we're having is, when does the American dream end in your life? Should it end when you're 60? Because I would argue for my parents' generation, you kind of live the dream and then you kind of enjoy the dream. And he has a great phrase, which is the third half of your life. Which is, the point is that you can continue to grow and learn and develop. Even if you're 50 years old, you can have a 30-year career in something and still be alive and live through it. So I think, you know, thinking about the dream and not assuming that the people we left behind, I think we have to make sure these people who didn't get decent educations we ought to figure out how to re-educate them, get them back into the system. Maybe that'll help on that. But I am a believer in America, so I would always say we should be optimistic in that while it's ugly and a little bumpy along the way, the system does work.
Let me thank all the panelists for joining us here today. Let's have a round of applause for them.